This is disc number two.
Jobs at the Vatican are highly coveted, Donati said. The salaries aren't terribly high, but all our employees have shopping privileges at the pharmacy and the supermarket. The prices are subsidized and much lower than those at Italian markets. The same is true for the prices at our gas station. Aside from that, the hours are reasonable, vacations are long, and the fringe benefits are quite good.
What about the background check for the people who get those jobs?
The jobs are so coveted, and there are so few of them, that they almost always go to someone with a family connection. So the background check is fairly cursory.
I was afraid of that, Gabriel said. And what about people like me, people with temporary credentials?
You're asking how many? Donati shrugged.
At any given time, I'd say there are several hundred people with temporary access to the Vatican.
How does the system work?
They're usually assigned to one of the various pontifical councils or commissions as support staff or professional consultants. The prefect or an undersecretary vouch for the character of the individual, and the Vatican Security Office issues the badges.
Does the Security Office keep all the paperwork?
Of course.
Gabriel lifted the receiver of the telephone and held it out to Donati. 20 minutes elapsed before Donati's phone rang again. He listened in silence, then replaced the receiver and looked at Gabriel, who was standing in the window overlooking the square, watching the crowds streaming into the square.
They're starting to pull the paperwork now.
Starting. It required authorization from the chief. He was in a meeting. They'll be ready for you in 15 minutes.
Gabriel looked at his wristwatch. It was nearly 10:30.
Move it indoors, he said.
The Holy Father won't hear of it.
Donati joined Gabriel at the window.
Besides, it's too late. The guests have started to arrive.
They settled him in a tiny cell with a sooty window overlooking the Belvedere courtyard, and gave him a boyish-looking ex-carabiniere named Luca Angeli to fetch the files. He limited his search to laypersons only. Even Gabriel, a man of boundless suspicion, could not imagine a scenario under which a Catholic priest could be recruited, knowingly or unwittingly, to the cause of Al-Qaeda. He also struck from his list members of the Swiss Guard and Vigilanza. The ranks of the Vigilanza were filled largely by former officers of the Carabinieri and Polizia di Stato. As for the Swiss Guard, they were drawn exclusively from Catholic families in Switzerland, and most came from the German and French-speaking cantons in the mountainous heart of the country, hardly a stronghold of Islamic extremism. He started with the lay employees of the Vatican City-State itself. To limit the parameters of his search, he reviewed only the files of those who had been hired in the previous 5 years. That alone took him nearly 30 minutes. When he was finished, he set aside a half dozen files for further evaluation. A clerk in the Vatican pharmacy, a gardener, 2 stock boys in the Annona, a janitor in the Vatican Museum, and a woman who worked in one of the Vatican gift shops, and gave the rest back to Angeli. The next files to arrive were for the lay employees attached to various congregations of the Roman Curia. The congregations were the approximate equivalent of government ministries and dealt with central areas of church governance, such as doctrine, faith, the clergy, saints, and Catholic education. Each congregation was led by a cardinal, and each cardinal had several bishops and monsignore beneath him. Gabriel reviewed the files for the clerical and support staff of each of the 9 congregations, and, finding nothing of interest, gave them back to Angeli.
What's left?
The pontifical commissions and councils, said Angeli, and the other offices.
Other offices?
The administration of the patrimony of the Holy See, the prefecture of the economic affairs of the Holy See.
I get it, Gabriel said.
How many files?
Angeli held up his hands to indicate that the pile was well over a foot high. Gabriel looked at his watch. 11:20.
Bring them.
Angeli started with the pontifical commissions. Gabriel pulled 2 more files for further review. A consultant to the Commission for Sacred Archaeology, and an Argentine scholar attached to the Pontifical Commission for Latin America. He gave the rest back to Angeli and looked at his watch. 11:45. He'd promised Donati that he would stand guard over the Pope in the square during the general audience at noon. He had time for only a few more files. "Skip the financial departments," Gabriel said. "Bring me the files for the Pontifical Councils." Angeli returned a moment later with a 6-inch stack of manila folders. Gabriel reviewed them in the order Angeli handed them over. The Pontifical Council for the Laity, the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity, the Pontifical Council for the Family, the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, the Pontifical Council for the Pastoral Care of Migrants and Itinerant People, the Pontifical Council for Legislative Texts, the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue. Gabriel held up his hand. He had found what he was looking for. He read for a moment, then looked up sharply. "Does this man really have access to the Vatican?" Angeli bent his thin body at the waist and peered over Gabriel's shoulder. "Professor Ibrahim El-Banna, he's been here for more than a year now."
"Doing what?"
"He's a member of a special commission searching for ways to improve relations between the Christian and Islamic worlds. There are 12 members in all, an ecumenical team of 6 Christian scholars and 6 Muslim scholars representing the various Islamic sects and schools of Islamic law. Ibrahim El-Banna is a professor of Islamic jurisprudence at Al-Azhar University in Cairo. He is also among the most respected scholars of the Hanafi school of Islamic law in the world. Hanafi is predominant among Sunni Muslims," Gabriel said, pointedly finishing Angeli's sentence for him.
"Don't you know that Al-Azhar is the hotbed of Islamic militancy? It's been thoroughly penetrated by the forces of Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood."
"It is also one of the oldest and most prestigious schools of Islamic theology and law in the world. Professor El-Banna was chosen for the position because of his moderate views. He's met several times with the Holy Father himself. On 2 occasions, they were alone together."
"Where does the commission meet?"
"Professor El-Banna has an office in a building near the Piazza Santa Marta, not far from the Arch of Bells." Gabriel looked at his watch. 11:55. There was no way to talk to Donati. He would be downstairs with the Pope by now, preparing to enter the square. He thought of the instructions he'd given him the previous night in the Via Belvedere. "Make a general nuisance of yourself. If you see a problem, address it." He got to his feet and looked at Angeli.
"I'd like to have a word with the Imam."
Angeli hesitated. "The initiative is very important to the Holy Father. If you level an accusation against Professor El-Banna without just cause, he will take great offense and the commission's work will be placed in jeopardy."
"Better an irate imam than a dead pope. What's the quickest way to the Piazza Santa Marta?"
"We'll take the shortcut," Angeli said, "through the Basilica." They slipped through the passage from the Scala Regia into the Chapel of the Blessed Sacrament, then hurried diagonally across the vast nave. Beneath the monument to Alexander VII was a doorway leading into the Piazza Santa Marta. As they stepped outside into the bright sunlight, a roar of wild applause rose from St. Peter's Square. The Pope had arrived for the general audience. Angeli led Gabriel across the small piazza and into a gloomy-looking Baroque office building. In the lobby, a nun sat motionless behind a reception table. She gave Gabriel and Angeli a disapproving look as they burst inside.
"Ibrahim El-Banna," said Luca Angeli without elaboration.
The nun blinked twice rapidly.
"Room 412.
They mounted the stairs, Angeli leading the way, Gabriel at his heels. When another swell of applause rose from the square, Gabriel gave Angeli a jab in the kidneys, and the Vatican security man began taking the steps 2 at a time. When they arrived at room 412, they found the door was closed. Gabriel reached for the latch, but Angeli stayed his hand and knocked firmly, but politely.
"Professor El-Banna! Professor El-Banna, are you there?"
Greeted by silence, Gabriel pushed Angeli aside and examined the ancient lock. With the slender metal pick in his wallet, he could have coaxed it open in a matter of seconds. But another roar of approval from the square reminded him there wasn't time. He seized hold of the latch with both hands and drove his shoulder into the door. It held fast. He threw his body against the door a second time, then a third. On the fourth attempt, Angeli joined him. The wood of the door jamb splintered, and they tumbled inside. The room was empty. Not just empty, thought Gabriel, abandoned. There were no books or files, no pens or loose papers, just a single letter-sized envelope positioned in the precise center of the desk. Angeli reached for the light switch, but Gabriel shouted at him not to touch it, then pushed the Italian back into the corridor. He drew a pen from his coat pocket and used it as a probe to examine the density of the envelope's contents. When he was reasonably certain it contained nothing but paper, he picked it up and carefully lifted the flap. Inside was a single sheet folded in thirds, handwritten Arabic script. "We declare war on you, the Crusaders, with the destruction of your infidel temple to polytheism and the death of your so-called supreme pontiff, this man in white who you treat as though he were a god. This is your punishment for the sins of Iraq, Abu Ghraib, and Guantanamo Bay. The attacks will continue until the land of Iraq is no longer in American bondage and Palestine has been liberated from the clutches of the Jews. We are the Brotherhood of Allah. There is no god but Allah, and all praise to him." Gabriel ran down the stairs, Angeli at his back. Chapter 6, Vatican City.
In nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti.
The Pope's voice, amplified by the Vatican public address system, resounded across St. Peter's Square and down the length of the Via della Conciliazione. 20,000 voices replied, "Amen." Gabriel and Luca Angeli sprinted across the Piazza Santa Marta, then along the exterior wall of the Basilica. Before reaching the Arch of Bells, Angeli turned to the right and entered the permissions office, the main security checkpoint for most visitors to the Vatican. If Ibrahim Elbana had cleared anyone else into the Vatican, the paperwork would exist there. Gabriel kept going toward the Arch of Bells. The Swiss guard on duty there, startled by the sight of a man running toward him, lowered his halberd defensively as Gabriel approached. He raised it again when he saw Gabriel waving his security office ID badge.
"Give me your sidearm," Gabriel ordered.
"Sir?"
"Give me your gun," Gabriel shouted at the guard in German.
The guard reached inside his multicolored Renaissance tunic and came out with a very modern Sig Sauer 9mm, just as Luca Angeli emerged from the archway.
"Elbana cleared a delegation of three German priests into the Vatican at 11:30.
"They're not priests, Luca. They're shahids, martyrs."
Gabriel looked at the crowd gathered in the square.
"And I doubt they're inside the Vatican any longer. They're probably out there now armed with explosives and only God knows what else."
"Why did they come through the Arch of Bells into the Vatican?"
"To get their bombs, of course."
It was the chink in the Vatican's security armor. The terrorists had discovered it through repeated surveillance and had used the Holy Father's initiative of peace to exploit it.
"Elbana probably smuggled the bombs inside over time and stored them in his office. The Shahids collected them after clearing security at the permissions office, then made their way into the square by some route without metal detectors."
"The Basilica," said Angeli. "They could have entered the Basilica from the side and come out through one of the front doors. We could have passed them a few moments ago, and we never would have known it."
Gabriel and Angeli vaulted the wooden fencing separating the Arch of Bells entrance area from the rest of the square and mounted the dais. Their sudden movement sent a murmur through the audience. Donati was standing behind the Pope. Gabriel went quietly to his side and handed him the note he'd taken from Elbana's office.
"They're here."
Donati looked down, saw the Arabic script, then looked up at Gabriel again.
"We found that in Ibrahim Elbana's office. It says they're going to destroy the Basilica. It says they're going to kill the Holy Father. We have to get him off the dais. Now, Luigi."
Donati looked out at the multitude in the square. Catholic pilgrims and dignitaries from around the globe. Schoolchildren in white. Groups of sick and elderly come to get the pontiff's blessing. The Pope was seated in a scarlet ceremonial throne. In the tradition he'd inherited from his predecessor, he was greeting the pilgrims in their native languages, moving rapidly from one to the next.
"And what about the pilgrims?" Donati asked. "How do we protect them?"
"It may be too late for them, some of them at least. If we try to warn them, there'll be panic. Get the Holy Father out of the square as quickly and quietly as possible. Then we'll start moving the pilgrims out."
Colonel Brunner, the Swiss Guard commandant, joined them on the dais. Like the rest of the Pope's personal security detail, he was dressed in a dark business suit and wore an earpiece. When Donati explained the situation, Brunner's face drained of color. "We'll take him through the Basilica." "And if they've concealed bombs in there?" Gabriel asked. Brunner opened his mouth to reply, but his words were swept away by a searing blast wave. The sound came a millisecond later, a deafening thunderclap made more intense by the vast echo chamber of St. Peter's Square. Gabriel was blown from the dais, a scrap of paper on a gale-force wind. His body took flight, turned over at least once. Then he landed hard on the steps of the basilica and blacked out. When he opened his eyes, he saw Christ's apostles peering down at him from their perch atop the facade. He did not know how long he was unconscious, a few seconds, perhaps, but not longer. He sat up, ears ringing, and looked around. To his right were the curial prelates who had been on the dais with the Pope. They appeared shocked and tousled, but largely unhurt. To his left lay Donati, and next to Donati was Karl Brunner. The commandant's eyes were closed, and he was bleeding heavily from a wound at the back of his head. Gabriel got to his feet and looked around. Where was the Pope? Ibrahim el-Bana had cleared three priests into the Vatican. Gabriel suspected there were two more blasts to come. He found the Sig Sauer he'd taken from the Swiss Guard and shouted at the prelates to stay down. Then, as he climbed back onto the dais to look for Lucchese, the second bomb exploded. Another wave of searing heat and wind. Another thunderclap. Gabriel was hurled backward. This time he came to rest atop Donati. He got to his feet again. He wasn't able to reach the dais before the third bomb detonated. When the thunderclap finally died out, he mounted the platform and looked out at the devastation. The Shahids had distributed themselves evenly throughout the crowd near the front of the dais, one near the bronze doors, the second in the center of the square, and the third close to the Arch of Bells. All that remained of them were three plumes of black smoke rising toward the cloudless, pale blue sky. On the spots where the bombers had been standing, the paving stones were blackened by fire, drenched in blood, and littered with human limbs and tissue. Farther away from the blast points, it was possible to imagine that the tattered corpses had moments before been human beings. The folding chairs that Gabriel had watched being put into place earlier that morning had been tossed about like playing cards, and everywhere there were shoes. How many dead? Hundreds, he thought. But his concern at that moment was not with the dead, but with the Holy Father. "We declare war on you, the Crusaders, with the destruction of your infidel temple to polytheism." The attack, Gabriel knew, was not yet finished. And then, through the screen of black smoke, he saw the next phase unfolding. A delivery van had stopped just beyond the barricade at the far end of the square. The rear cargo doors were open and three men were scrambling out. Each one had a shoulder-launch missile. It was then that Gabriel saw the throne on which the Pope had been seated. It had been blown sideways by the force of the first blast, and had come to rest upside down on the steps of the basilica. Poking from beneath it was a small hand with a gold ring, and the skirt of a white cassock stained in blood. Gabriel looked at Donati. "They've got missiles, Luigi. Get everyone away from the basilica." Gabriel leaped from the dais and lifted the throne. The Pope's eyes were closed, and he was bleeding from several small cuts. As Gabriel reached down and cradled the Pope in his arms, he heard the distinctive whoosh of an approaching RPG-7. He turned his head long enough to glimpse the missile streaking over the square toward the basilica. An instant later, the warhead struck Michelangelo's dome and exploded in a shower of fire, glass, and stone. Gabriel sheltered the Pope from the falling debris, then lifted him and started running toward the bronze doors. Before they could reach the shelter of the colonnade, the second missile came streaking across the square. It struck the facade of the basilica just beneath the balustrade on the Loggia of the Blessings. Gabriel lost his balance and fell to the paving stones. He lifted his head and saw the third missile on its way. It was coming in lower than the others and heading directly toward the dais. In the instant before it struck, Gabriel glimpsed a nightmarish image. Luigi Donati trying desperately to move the curial cardinals and prelates to safety. Gabriel stayed on the ground and covered the Pope's body with his own as another shower of wreckage rained down upon them.
"Is it you, Gabriel?"
the Pope asked, eyes still closed.
"Yes, Holiness."
"Is it over?"
Three bombs, three missiles, symbolic of the Holy Trinity, Gabriel reckoned. a calculated insult to the Mushrikun.
Yes, Holiness, I believe it's over.
Where's Luigi?
Gabriel looked toward the burning remains of the dais and saw Donati stagger out of the smoke, the body of a dead cardinal in his arms.
He's alive, Holiness.
The Pope closed his eyes and whispered,
Thank God.
Gabriel felt a hand grasp his shoulder. He turned around and saw a quartet of men in blue suits, guns drawn.
Let go of him,
one of the men shouted.
We'll take him from here.
Gabriel looked at the man for a moment, then slowly shook his head. I've got him, he said. Then he stood up and carried the Pope into the Apostolic Palace, surrounded by Swiss guards. The apartment house stood in a cobbled vicolo near the Church of Santa Maria in Trastevere. 4 floors in height, its faded tan exterior was hung with power and telephone lines, and contained several large patches of exposed brickwork. On the ground floor was a small motorcycle repair shop that spilled into the street. To the right of the shop was a doorway leading to the flats above. Ibrahim El-Bana had the key in his pocket. The attack had commenced 5 minutes after El-Bana's departure from the Vatican. On the Borgo Santo Spirito, he had taken advantage of the panic to carefully remove his kufi and hang a large wooden cross around his neck. From there, he had walked to the Janiculum Park, and from the park down the hill to Trastevere. On the Via della Paglia, a distraught woman had asked El-Bana for his blessing. He had bestowed it, imitating the words and gestures he'd seen at the Vatican, then immediately asked Allah to forgive his blasphemy. Now, safely inside the apartment house, he removed the offensive cross from his neck and mounted the dimly lit stairs. He had been ordered to come here by the Saudi who had conceived and planned the attack, the Saudi he knew only as Halil. It was to be the first stop on a secret journey out of Europe and back to the Muslim world. He had hoped to return to his native Egypt, but Halil had convinced him that he would never be safe there.
The American lackey Mubarak will hand you over to the infidels in the blink of an eye, Halil had said. There's only one place on earth where the infidels can't get you.
That place was Saudi Arabia, land of the Prophet, birthplace of Wahhabi Islam. Ibrahim El-Bana had been promised a new identity, a teaching position at the prestigious University of Medina, and a bank account with $500,000. The sanctuary was a reward from Prince Nabil, the Saudi interior minister. The money was a gift from the Saudi billionaire who had financed the operation. And so the Muslim cleric who climbed the steps of the Roman apartment house was a contented man. He had just helped carry off one of the most important acts of jihad in the long, glorious history of Islam, and now he was setting out for a new life in Saudi Arabia, where his words and beliefs could help inspire the next generation of Islamic warriors. Only paradise would be sweeter. He reached the third floor landing and went to the door of apartment 3A. When he inserted the key into the lock, he felt a slight electric shock in his fingers. When he turned it, the door exploded. And then he felt nothing at all. At that same moment, in the section of Washington known as Foggy Bottom, a woman woke from a nightmare. It was filled with the same imagery she saw every morning at this time. A flight attendant with her throat slashed, a handsome young passenger making one final phone call, an inferno. She rolled over and looked at the clock on her nightstand. It was 6:30. She picked up the remote control, aimed it at her television, and pressed the power button. God, no, she thought when she saw the basilica in flames. Not again. Chapter 7. Rome. Gabriel remained at the safe flat near the Church of the Trinità dei Monti for the next week. There were moments when it seemed as though none of it had really happened, but then he would wander out to the balcony and see the dome of the basilica looming over the rooftops of the city, shattered and blackened by fire, as if God, in a moment of disapproval or carelessness, had reached down and destroyed the handiwork of his children. Gabriel, the restorer, wished it was only a painting, and a braided canvas that he might heal with a bottle of linseed oil and a bit of pigment. The death toll climbed with each passing day. By the end of Wednesday, Black Wednesday, as Rome's newspapers christened it, the number of dead stood at 600. By Thursday it was 650, and by the weekend it had exceeded 700. Colonel Karl Brunner of the Pontifical Swiss Guards was among the dead. So was Luca Angeli, who clung to life for 3 days in the Gemelli Clinic before being removed from life support. The Pope administered last rites and remained at Angeli's side until he died. The Roman Curia suffered terrible losses. 4 cardinals were among the dead, along with 8 curial bishops and 3 monsignori. Their funerals had to be conducted in the Basilica of St. John Lateran, because 2 days after the attack, an international team of structural engineers concluded the basilica was unsafe to enter. Rome's largest newspaper, La Repubblica, reported the news by printing a full-page photograph of the ruined dome, headlined with a single word, "Condemned." Since no Israelis were among the dead, the government of Israel had no official standing in the investigation. But Gabriel, with his proximity to Donati and the Pope, quickly came to know as much about the attack as any intelligence officer in the world. He gathered most of his intelligence at the Pope's dinner table, where he sat each evening with the men leading the investigation, General Marchese of the Carabinieri and Martino Bellano of the Italian Security Service. For the most part, they spoke freely in front of Gabriel, and anything they withheld was dutifully passed along to him by Donati. Gabriel, in turn, forwarded all his information to King Saul Boulevard, which explained why Shamron was in no hurry to see him leave Rome. Within 48 hours of the attack, the Italians had managed to identify all those involved. The missile strike had been carried out by a 4-man team. The driver of the van was of Tunisian origin. The 3 men who fired the RPG-7s were of Jordanian nationality and were veterans of the insurgency in Iraq. All 4 were killed in a volley of Carabinieri gunfire seconds after launching their weapons. As for the 3 men who had posed as German priests, only one was actually German, a young engineering student from Hamburg named Manfred Ziegler. The 2nd was a Dutchman from Rotterdam, and the 3rd was a Flemish-speaking Belgian from Antwerp. All 3 were Muslim converts, and all had taken part in anti-American and anti-Israeli demonstrations. Gabriel, though he had no proof of it, suspected they had been recruited by Professor Ali Massoudi. Using closed-circuit surveillance video and eyewitness accounts, the Vatican and Italian authorities were able to retrace the last moments of the bombers' lives. After being admitted into the Vatican by an addetto at the permissions office, the 3 men had made their way to Ibrahim Elbana's office near the Piazza Santa Marta. Upon leaving, each was carrying a large briefcase. As Angeli had suspected, the 3 men had then slipped into the basilica through a side entrance. They made their way into St. Peter's Square, fittingly enough, through the Door of Death. The door, like the other 4 doors leading from the basilica into the square, should have been locked. By the end of the first week, the Vatican police still had not determined why it wasn't. The body of Ibrahim Elbana was identified 3 days after it was pulled from the rubble of the apartment house in Trastevere. For the time being, his true affiliation remained a matter of speculation. Who were the Brotherhood of Allah? Were they an Al-Qaeda offshoot or simply Al-Qaeda by another name? And who had planned and financed so elaborate an operation? One thing was immediately clear. The attack on the home of Christendom had reignited the fires of the global jihadist movement. Wild street celebrations erupted in Tehran, Cairo, Beirut, and the Palestinian territories, while intelligence analysts from Washington to London to Tel Aviv immediately detected a sharp spike in activity and recruitment. On the following Wednesday, the 1-week anniversary of the attack, Shamron decided it was time for Gabriel to come home. As he was packing his bag in the safe flat, the red light on the telephone flashed to indicate an incoming call. He raised the receiver and heard Donati's voice.
The Holy Father would like a word with you in private.
When?
This afternoon, before you leave for the airport.
A word about what?
You are a member of a very small club, Gabriel Alon.
Which club is that?
Men who would dare to ask a question such as that.
Where and when? Gabriel asked, his tone conciliatory. Donati gave him the information. Gabriel hung up the phone and finished packing. St. Peter's Square was still closed to the public. Gabriel cleared a Carabinieri checkpoint at the edge of the colonnade and made his way across the paving stones through the dying twilight. The forensic crews had completed their gruesome task, but the opaque barriers that had been erected around the 3 blast sites remained in place. An enormous white tarpaulin hung from the facade of the basilica, concealing the blackened damage beneath the loggia of the blessings.
It bore the image of a dove and a single word written in huge lettering, Peace. He passed through the Arch of Bells and made his way along the left flank of the basilica. The side entrances were closed and barricaded, and Vigilanza officers stood watch at each one. In the Vatican Gardens, it was possible to imagine that nothing had happened. Possible, thought Gabriel, until one looked at the ruined dome, which was lit now by a dusty Siena sunset. The Pope was waiting near the house of the gardener. He greeted Gabriel warmly, and together they set out toward the distant corner of the Vatican. A dozen Swiss guards in plain clothes drifted alongside them amid the stone pines, their long shadows thin upon the grass.
Luigi and I have pleaded with the Swiss guard to reduce the size of their detail, the Pope said. For the moment, it is non-negotiable. They're a bit jumpy, for understandable reasons. Not since the sack of Rome has a Swiss guard commander died defending the Vatican from enemy attack.
They walked on in silence for a moment.
So, this is my fate, Gabriel, to be forever surrounded by men with radios and guns. How can I communicate with my flock? How can I give comfort to the sick and the afflicted, if I am cut off from them by a phalanx of bodyguards?
Gabriel had no good answer.
It will never be the same, will it, Gabriel?
No, Holiness, I'm afraid it will not.
Did they mean to kill me?
Without a doubt.
Will they try again?
Once they set their sights on a target, they usually don't stop until they succeed. But in this case, they managed to kill 700 pilgrims and several cardinals and bishops, not to mention the commandant of the Swiss Guard. They also managed to inflict severe physical damage to the basilica itself. In my opinion, they will regard their historical account as settled.
They may not have succeeded in killing me, but they have succeeded in making me a prisoner of the Vatican.
The Pope stopped and looked at the ruined dome.
My cage isn't so gilded anymore. It took more than a century to build and a few seconds to destroy.
It's not destroyed, Holiness. The dome can be restored.
That remains to be seen,
the Pope said with uncharacteristic gloominess.
The engineers and architects aren't so sure it can be done. It might have to be brought down and rebuilt entirely. And the baldacchino suffered severe damage when the debris rained down upon it. This is not something that can simply be replaced. But then you know that better than most.
Gabriel snuck a glance at his wristwatch. He would have to be leaving for the airport soon, or he would miss his flight. He wondered why the Pope had asked him here. Surely it wasn't to discuss the restoration of the basilica. The Pope turned and started walking again. They were heading toward St. John's Tower at the southwest corner of the Vatican.
There's only one reason why I'm not dead now, the Pope said. And that's because of you, Gabriel. In all the sorrow and confusion of this terrible week, I haven't had the chance to properly thank you. I'm doing so now. I only wish I could do so in public.
Gabriel's role in the affair had been carefully guarded from the media. So far, against all the odds, it had remained a secret.
And I only wish I'd discovered Ibrahim Albana sooner, Gabriel said. 700 people might still be alive.
You did everything that could have been done.
Perhaps, Holiness, but it still wasn't enough.
They arrived at the Vatican wall. The Pope mounted a stone staircase and climbed upward, Gabriel following silently after him. They stood at the parapet and looked out over Rome. Lights were coming on all over the city. Gabriel glanced over his shoulder and saw the Swiss guards stirring nervously beneath them. He gave them a reassuring hand gesture and looked at the Pope, who was peering downward at the cars racing along the Viale Vaticano.
Luigi tells me a promotion awaits you in Tel Aviv.
He had to raise his voice over the din of the traffic.
Is this a promotion you sought for yourself, or is this the work of Sharon?
Some have greatness thrust upon them, Holiness.
The Pope smiled, the first Gabriel had seen on his face since his arrival in Rome.
"May I give you a small piece of advice?"
Gabriel nodded.
"Use your power wisely, even though you will find yourself in a position to punish your enemies. Use your power to pursue peace at every turn. Seek justice rather than vengeance."
Gabriel was tempted to remind the Pope that he was only a secret servant of the state. The decisions of war and peace were in the hands of men far more powerful than he. Instead, he assured the Pope that he would take his advice to heart.
"Will you search for the men who attacked the Vatican?"
"It's not our fight, not yet, at least."
"Something tells me it will be soon."
The Pope was watching the traffic below him with a childlike fascination.
"It was my idea to put the Dove of Peace on the shroud covering the facade of the Basilica. I'm sure you find the sentiment hopelessly naive. You probably consider me naive as well."
"I wouldn't want to live in this world without men such as you, Holiness."
Gabriel made no attempt to hide the next glance at his watch.
"Your plane awaits you?"
the Pope asked.
"Yes, Holiness."
"Come," he said.
"I'll see you out."
Gabriel started toward the steps, but the Pope remained at the parapet.
"Francesco Tiepolo called me this morning from Venice. He sends his regards."
He turned and looked at Gabriel.
"So does Chiara."
Gabriel was silent.
"She says she wants to see you before you go home to Israel. She was wondering whether you might stop in Venice on your way out of the country."
The Pope took Gabriel by the elbow and, smiling, led him down the steps.
"I realize I have very little experience when it comes to matters of the heart, but will you allow an old man to give you one more piece of advice?"
Chapter 8. Venice. It was a small terracotta church built for a poor parish in the sestiere of Cannaregio. The plot of land had been too cramped for a proper church square, so the main entrance opened directly into the busy Salizada San Giovanni Crisostomo. Gabriel had once carried a key to the church in his pocket. Now he entered like an ordinary tourist and paused for a moment in the vestibule, waiting for his eyes to adjust to the dim light while a breath of cool air, scented with candle wax and incense, brushed against his cheek. He thought of the last time he had set foot in the church. It was the night Chamron had come to Venice to tell Gabriel that he had been discovered by his enemies, and that it was time for him to come home again.
"There'll be no trace of you here," Chamron had said. "It will be as though you never existed."
He crossed the intimate nave to the chapel of St. Jerome on the right side of the church. The altarpiece was concealed by heavy shadow. Gabriel dropped a coin into the light meter, and the lamps flickered into life, illuminating the last great work ever painted by Bellini. He stood for a moment, right hand pressed to his chin, head tilted slightly to one side, examining the painting in raked lighting. Francesco Tiepolo had done a fine job finishing it for him. Indeed, it was nearly impossible for Gabriel to tell where his impainting left off and Tiepolo's began. Hardly surprising, he thought. They had both served their apprenticeships with the master Venetian restorer, Umberto Conti. The meter ran out, and the lights switched off automatically, plunging the painting into darkness again. Gabriel went back into the street and made his way westward across Cannaregio until he came to an iron bridge, the only one in all of Venice. In the Middle Ages there had been a gate in the center of the bridge, and at night a Christian watchman had stood guard so that those imprisoned on the other side could not escape. He crossed the bridge and entered a darkened sotoportego. At the end of the passageway, a broad square opened before him, the Campo di Ghetto Nuovo, center of the ancient ghetto of Venice. More than 5,000 Jews had once lived in the ghetto. Now it was home to only 20 of the city's 400 Jews, and most of those were elderly who resided in the Casa Israelitica di Riposo. He crossed the Campo and stopped at number 2899. A small brass plaque read, "Comunità Ebraica di Venezia." Jewish Community of Venice. He pressed the bell and quickly turned his back to the security camera over the doorway. After a long silence, a woman's voice, familiar to him, crackled over the intercom.
"Turn around," she said. "Let me have a look at your face."
He waited where she had told him to wait, on a wooden bench in a sunlit corner of the campo, near a memorial for the Venetian Jews who were rounded up in December 1943 and sent to their deaths at Auschwitz. 10 minutes elapsed, then 10 minutes more. When finally she emerged from the office, she took her time crossing the square, then stopped several feet away from him, as though she were afraid to come any closer. Gabriel, still seated, pushed his sunglasses onto his forehead and regarded her in the dazzling autumn light. She wore faded blue jeans, snug around her long thighs and flared at the bottom, and a pair of high-heeled suede boots. Her white blouse was tailored in such a way that it left no doubt about the generous figure beneath it. Her riotous auburn hair was held back by a chocolate-colored satin ribbon, and a silk scarf was wound round her neck. Her olive skin was very dark. Gabriel suspected she'd been to the sun recently. Her eyes, wide and oriental in shape, were the color of caramel and flecked with gold. They tended to change color with her mood. The last time Gabriel had seen Chiara's eyes, they were nearly black with anger and streaked with mascara. She folded her arms defensively beneath her breasts and asked what he was doing in Venice. "Hello, Chiara. Don't you look lovely?" The breeze took her hair and blew a few strands across her face. She brushed it away with her left hand. It was absent the diamond engagement ring Gabriel had given her. There were other rings on her fingers now and a new gold watch on her wrist. Gabriel wondered if they were gifts from someone else.
"I haven't heard from you since I left Jerusalem," Chiara said in the deliberately even tone she used whenever she was trying to keep her emotions in check. "It's been months. Now you show up here without warning and expect me to greet you with my arms open and a smile on my face?"
"Without warning? I came here because you asked me to come."
"Me? What on earth are you talking about?"
Gabriel searched her eyes. He could tell she was not dissembling.
"Forgive me," he said. "It seems I was brought here under false pretenses."
She toyed with the ends of her scarf, clearly enjoying his discomfort.
"Brought here by whom?"
"Donati and Tiepolo," reckoned Gabriel. "Maybe even His Holiness himself." He stood abruptly.
"It doesn't matter," he said. "I'm sorry, Chiara. It was nice to see you again."
He turned and started to walk away, but she seized his arm.
"Wait," she said. "Stay for a moment."
"Are you going to be civil?"
"Civility is for divorced couples with children."
Gabriel sat down again, but Chiara remained standing. A man in dark glasses and a tan blazer emerged from the Sotoportego. He looked admiringly at Chiara, then crossed the campo and disappeared over the bridge that led to the pair of old Sephardic synagogues at the southern end of the ghetto. Chiara watched the man go, then tilted her head and scrutinized Gabriel's appearance.
"Has anyone ever told you that you bear more than a passing resemblance to the man who saved the Pope?"
"He's an Italian," Gabriel said. "Didn't you read about him in the newspapers?"
She ignored him.
"When I saw the footage on television, I thought I was hallucinating. I knew it was you. That night, after things calmed down, I checked in with Rome. Shimon told me you'd been at the Vatican."
A sudden movement in the campo caused her to turn her head. She watched as a man with a salt-and-pepper beard and a fedora hat hurried toward the entrance of the community center. It was her father, the chief rabbi of Venice. She raised the toe of her right boot and balanced her weight on the heel. Gabriel knew the gesture well. It meant something provocative was coming.
"Why are you here, Gabriel Alon?"
"I was told you wanted to see me."
"And so you came. Just like that."
"Just like that."
The corners of her lips started to curl into a smile.
"What's so funny?" he asked.
"Poor Gabriel. You're still in love with me, aren't you?"
"I always was."
"Just not enough to marry me."
"Can we do this in private?"
"Not for a while. I need to keep an eye on the office. My other job,"
she said in a tone of mock conspiracy. Please give Rabbi Zoli my regards. I'm not sure that's such a good idea. Rabbi Zoli is still furious with you. She dug a key from her pocket and tossed it to him. He looked at it for a long moment. Even after months of separation, it was difficult for Gabriel to imagine Chiara leading a life of her own.
In case you're wondering, I live there alone. It's more than you have a right to know, but it's the truth. Make yourself comfortable. Get some rest. You look like hell.
Full of compliments today, aren't we? He slipped the key into his pocket. What's the address?
You know, for a spy, you're a terrible liar.
What are you talking about?
You know my address, Gabriel. You got it from operations, the same place you got my telephone number.
She leaned down and kissed his cheek. When her hair fell across his face, he closed his eyes and inhaled the scent of vanilla. Her building was on the other side of the Grand Canal in Santa Croce, in a small enclosed corte with but one passage in and out. Gabriel, as he slipped into her apartment, had the sensation of walking into his own past. The sitting room seemed posed for a magazine photo shoot. Even her old magazines and newspapers appeared to have been arranged by a fanatic in pursuit of visual perfection. He walked over to an end table and browsed the framed photographs. Chiara and her parents, Chiara and an older brother who lived in Padua, Chiara with a friend on the shore of the Sea of Galilee. It was during that trip, when she was just 25, that she'd come to the attention of an office talent scout. 6 months later, after being vetted and trained, she was sent back to Europe as a Bat Leveja, a female escort officer. There were no photographs of Chiara with Gabriel, for none existed. He went to the window and looked out. 30 feet below, the oily green waters of the Rio del Meggio flowed sluggishly by. A clothing line stretched to the building opposite. Shirts and trousers hung drunkenly in the sunlight, and at the other end of the line, an old woman sat in an open window with her fleshy arm draped over the sill. She seemed surprised to see Gabriel. He held up the key and said he was Chiara's friend from Milan. He lowered the blinds and went into the kitchen. In the sink was a half-drunk bowl of milky coffee and a crust of buttered toast. Chiara, fastidious in all other things, always left her breakfast dishes in the sink until the end of the day. Gabriel, in an act of domestic pettiness, left them where they stood and went into her bedroom. He tossed his bag onto the unmade bed, and, resisting the temptation to search her closet and drawers, went into the bathroom and turned on the shower. He opened the medicine chest, looking for razors or cologne or any other evidence of a man. There were two things he'd never seen before, a bottle of sleeping tablets and a second bottle of antidepressants. He returned them to the precise position in which he'd found them. Chiara, like Gabriel, had been trained to notice even the subtlest of changes. He stripped off his clothes and tossed them into the hallway, then spent a long time standing beneath the shower. When he was finished, he wrapped a towel around his waist and padded into the bedroom. The duvet smelled of Chiara's body. When he placed his head atop her pillow, the bells of Santa Croce tolled midday. He closed his eyes and plunged into a dreamless sleep. He woke in late afternoon to the sound of a key being pushed into the lock, followed by the clatter of Chiara's boot heels in the entrance hall. She didn't bother calling out that she was home. She knew he came awake at the slightest sound or movement. When she entered the bedroom, she was singing softly to herself, a silly Italian pop song she knew he loathed. She sat on the edge of the bed, close enough so that her hip pressed against his thigh. He opened his eyes and watched her remove her boots and wriggle out of her jeans. She pressed her palm against his chest. When he pulled the ribbon from her hair, auburn curls tumbled about her face and shoulders. She repeated the question she had posed to him in the ghetto.
Why are you here, Gabriel, alone?
I was wondering whether we might try this again, Gabriel said.
I don't need to try it. I tried it once, and I liked it very much.
He unwound the silk scarf from her throat and slowly loosened the buttons of her blouse. Chiara leaned down and kissed his mouth. It was like being kissed by Raphael's Alba Madonna.
If you hurt me again, I'll hate you forever.
I won't hurt you.
I never stopped dreaming of you.
Good dreams?
No, she said. I dreamt only of your death.
The only trace of Gabriel in the apartment was an old sketch pad. He had it when they lived in Venice together, and Chiara, without his knowledge, had stolen it from the apartment in Nakis Street the day she walked out on him. He turned to a fresh page and regarded her body with a professional dispassion. She was seated at the end of the couch, with her long legs folded beneath her, and her body wrapped in a cotton bedsheet. Her face was turned toward the window and lit by the setting sun. Gabriel was relieved to see the first lines around Chiara's eyes. He always feared she was far too young for him, and that one day, when he was old, she would leave him for another man. He tugged at the bedsheet, exposing her breast. She held his gaze for a moment, then closed her eyes.
"You're lucky I was here," she said. "I might have been away on assignment."
She was a talker. Gabriel had learned long ago it was pointless to ask her to remain silent while posing for him.
"You haven't worked since that job in Switzerland."
"How do you know about that operation?"
Gabriel gave her an inscrutable glance over the top of his sketch pad and reminded her not to move.
"So much for the concept of need to know. It seems you can walk into operations any time you feel like it and find out what I'm doing."
She started to turn her head, but Gabriel stilled her with a sharp,
"But I shouldn't be surprised. Have they given you the directorate yet?"
"Which directorate is that?" Gabriel said, being deliberately obtuse.
"Special operations."
Gabriel confessed that the post had been offered and accepted.
"So, you're my boss now," she pointed out. "I suppose we just violated about a half dozen different office edicts about fraternization between senior officers and staff."
"At least," said Gabriel. "But my promotion isn't official yet."
"Oh, thank goodness. I wouldn't want the great Gabriel to get into any sort of trouble because of his sex life. How much longer are we allowed to plunder each other's bodies before we run into trouble with personnel?"
"As long as we like. You'll just have to go on the record with them at some point."
"And what about God, Gabriel? Will you go on the record with God this time?"
There was silence, except for the scratching of a charcoal pencil across paper. She changed the subject.
"How much do you know about what I was doing in Switzerland?"
"I know that you went to Zermatt to seduce a Swiss arms merchant who was about to make a deal with someone who didn't have our best interests at heart. Kingsall Boulevard wanted to know when the shipment was leaving and where it was bound."
After a long silence, he asked her whether she had slept with the Swiss.
"It wasn't that kind of operation. I was working with another agent. I just kept the arms dealer entertained in the bar while the other agent broke into his room and stole the contents of his computer. Besides, you know that the bottle of Eja isn't supposed to be used for sex. We hire professionals for that sort of thing."
"Not always."
"I could never use my body like that. I'm a religious girl."
She smiled at him mischievously.
"We got it, by the way. The boat had a mysterious accident near the coast of Crete. The weapons are now on the bottom of the sea."
"I know," Gabriel said. "Close your eyes again."
"Make me," she said.
Then she smiled and did what he wanted.
"Aren't you going to ask me whether I was with anyone while we were apart?"
"It's none of my business."
"But you must be curious. I can only imagine what you did to my apartment when you walked through the door."
"If you're suggesting I searched your things, I didn't."
"Oh, please."
"Why can't you sleep?"
"Do you really want me to answer that?"
He made no reply.
"There was no one else, Gabriel. But then you knew that, didn't you? How could there be?"
She gave him a bittersweet smile.
"They never tell you that when they ask you to join their exclusive club. They never tell you how the lies begin to add up, or that you'll never be comfortable around people who aren't members. Is that the only reason why you fell in love with me, Gabriel? Because I was office?"
"I like your fettuccine and mushrooms. You make the best fettuccine and mushrooms in all of Venice."
"What about you? Were you with any other women while I was gone?"
"I spent all my time with a very large canvas."
"Ah, yes, I forgot about your affliction. You can't make love to a woman unless she knows you've killed on behalf of your country. I'm sure you could have found someone suitable at King Saul Boulevard if you'd set your mind to it. Every woman in the office lusts after you."
You're talking too much. I'll never finish this if you keep talking.
I'm hungry. You shouldn't have mentioned food.
How's Leia, by the way? Gabriel stopped sketching and glared at Kiara over the top of the sketchpad, as if to tell her he did not appreciate the rather cavalier juxtaposition of food and his wife.
I'm sorry, Kiara said. How is she?
Gabriel heard himself say that Leia was doing well, that 2 or 3 days a week he drove up to the psychiatric hospital atop Mount Herzl to spend a few minutes with her. But as he told her these things, his mind was elsewhere, on a tiny street in Vienna, not far from the Judenplatz, on the car bomb that killed his son and the inferno that destroyed Leia's body and stole her memory. For 13 years she had been silent in his presence. Now, for brief periods, she spoke to him. Recently, in the garden of the hospital, she had posed to him the same question Kiara had a moment earlier. Were there other women while I was gone? He had answered her truthfully.
Did you love this girl, Gabriel?
I loved her, but I gave her up for you.
Why on earth would you do that, my love? Look at me. There's nothing left of me. Nothing but a memory.
Kiara had lapsed into silence. The light on her face was fading slowly from coral red to gray. The plump woman appeared in the window opposite and began reeling in her laundry. Kiara lifted the bedsheet to her throat. What are you doing?
I don't want Signora Lorenzetto to see me naked.
Gabriel, in pulling the sheet down to its original position, left a smudge of charcoal on her breast.
I suppose I have to move back to Jerusalem, she said, unless you feel like telling Shamron that you can't take over special ops because you're coming back to Venice.
It's tempting, Gabriel said.
Tempting, but not possible. You are a loyal soldier, Gabriel. You always do what you're told. You always did.
She brushed the charcoal from her breast.
At least I won't have to decorate the apartment.
Gabriel's eyes remained downward toward the sketch pad. Kiara studied his expression, then asked,
Gabriel, what have you done to the apartment?
I'm afraid I needed a place to work.
So you just moved some things around?
You know I'm getting hungry, too.
Gabriel alone, is there anything left?
It's warm tonight, he said. Let's take the boat out to Murano and have fish. Chapter 9. Jerusalem. It was 8 o'clock the following evening when Gabriel returned to Narkis Street. Shamron's car was parked at the curb, and Rami, his bodyguard, was standing watch in the walkway outside number 16. Upstairs, Gabriel found all the lights on and Shamron drinking coffee at the kitchen table.
How did you get in? In case you've forgotten, this used to be an office safe flat. There's a key in housekeeping.
Yes, but I changed the locks over the summer.
Really? I guess I'll have to change them again. Don't bother.
Gabriel pushed open the window to vent the smoke from the room. 6 cigarette butts lay like spent bullets in one of Gabriel's saucers. Shamron had been here for some time.
How was Venice? Shamron asked.
Venice was lovely, but the next time you break into my flat, please have the courtesy of not smoking. Gabriel picked up the saucer by the edge and poured the cigarette butts into the garbage.
What's so urgent it couldn't wait till the morning? Another Saudi link to the attack on the Vatican.
Gabriel looked up at Shamron. What is it?
Ibrahim El Banna.
The Egyptian cleric? Why am I not surprised? Gabriel sat down at the table.
2 nights ago, our station chief in Cairo held a secret meeting with one of our top sources inside the Egyptian Mukhabarat. It seems Professor Ibrahim El Banna had a well-established militant pedigree long before he went to the Vatican. His older brother was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood and was a close associate of Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number 2 man in Al-Qaeda. A nephew went to Iraq to fight the Americans and was killed in the siege of Fallujah. Apparently, tapes of the Imam's sermons are required listening among Egyptian Islamic militants.
Too bad our friend in the Mukhabarat didn't tell the Vatican the truth about Elbana. 700 people might be alive, and the dome of the Basilica might not have a hole in it.
The Egyptians knew something else about Professor Elbana, Shamron said. Throughout much of the 80s and 90s, when the problem of Islamic fundamentalism was exploding in Egypt, Professor Elbana received regular cash payments and instructions from a Saudi who posed as an official of the International Islamic Relief Organization, one of the main Saudi charities. This man called himself Khalil, but Egyptian intelligence knew his real name, Ahmed bin Shafiq. What makes this even more interesting is bin Shafiq's occupation at that time.
He was GID, said Gabriel.
Exactly.
The GID, or General Intelligence Department, was the name of the Saudi Intelligence Service.
What do we know about him? Until 4 years ago, bin Shafiq was chief of a clandestine GID unit codenamed Group 205, which was responsible for establishing and maintaining links between Saudi Arabia and Islamic militant groups around the Middle East. Egypt was one of Group 205's top priorities, along with Afghanistan, of course.
What's the significance of the number?
It was the extension of bin Shafiq's office in GID headquarters.
What happened 4 years ago?
Bin Shafiq and his operatives were funneling materiel and money to the terrorists of Hamas and Islamic Jihad. A Palestinian informant told us about the operation, and we told the Americans. The American president showed our evidence to the king and brought pressure on him to shut down Group 205. That was 6 months after 9/11, and the king had no choice but to accede to the president's wishes, much to the dismay of bin Shafiq and other hardliners inside the kingdom. Group 205 was terminated, and bin Shafiq was run out of the GID.
Has he ever gone over to the other side of the street?
Are you asking whether he's a terrorist? The answer is we don't know. What we do know is that Islamic militancy is in his blood. His grandfather was a commander of the Ikhwan, the Islamic movement created by Ibn Saud at the turn of the 19th century in the Najd.
Gabriel knew the Ikhwan well. In many respects, they were the prototype and spiritual precursor of today's Islamic militant groups.
Where else did bin Shafiq operate when he was with Group 205? Afghanistan, Pakistan, Jordan, Lebanon, Algeria. We even suspect he's been in the West Bank.
So it's possible we're dealing with someone who has terrorist contacts ranging from Al-Qaeda to Hamas to the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt. If bin Shafiq has gone over to the other side, he's the nightmare scenario. The perfect terrorist mastermind.
We found another interesting tidbit in our own files, Shamron said. About 2 years ago, we were receiving reports of a Saudi trolling the camps of southern Lebanon, looking for experienced fighters. According to the reports, this Saudi called himself Khalil, the same name bin Shafiq used in Cairo. Unfortunately, we didn't pursue it. Frankly, if we chased down every moneyed Saudi who was trying to raise an army to wage jihad, we wouldn't get much else done. Hindsight, as they say, is 20/20.
How much more do we have on bin Shafiq?
Precious little, I'm afraid.
What about the photograph?
Shamron shook his head.
As you might expect, he's somewhat camera shy.
We need to share, Ari. The Italians need to know that there may be a Saudi connection. So do the Americans.
I know.
Shamron's tone was gloomy. The idea of sharing a hard-won piece of intelligence was heresy to him, especially if nothing was to be gained in return.
It used to be blue and white, he said,
referencing the national colors of Israel.
That was our motto, our belief system. We did things ourselves. We didn't ask others for help, and we didn't help others with problems of their own making.
The world has changed, Ari.
Perhaps it's a world I'm not cut out for. When we were fighting the PLO or Black September, It was simple Newtonian physics. Hit them here, squeeze them there. Watch them, listen to them, identify the members of their organization, eliminate their leadership. Now we're fighting a movement, a cancer that has metastasized to every vital organ of the body. It's like trying to capture fog in a glass. The old rules don't apply. Blue and white isn't enough. I can tell you one thing, though. This isn't going to go down well in Washington. The Saudis have many friends there.
Money will do that, Gabriel said. But the Americans need to know the truth about their best friend in the Arab world.
They know the truth. They just don't want to face it. The Americans know that in many ways the Saudis are the wellspring of Islamic terrorism. That the Saudis planted the seeds, watered them with petrodollars, and fertilized them with Wahhabi hatred and propaganda. The Americans seem content to live with this, as if Saudi-inspired terrorism is just a small surcharge on every tank of gasoline. What they don't understand is that terrorism can never be defeated unless they go after the source, Riyadh and the Al-Saud.
All the more reason to share with them intelligence linking the GID and the Al-Saud to the attack on the Vatican.
I'm glad you think so, because you've been nominated to go to Washington to brief them on what we know.
When do I leave?
Tomorrow morning.
Chamron looked absently out the window and for the second time asked Gabriel about his trip to Venice.
I was lured there under false pretenses, Gabriel said, but I'm glad I went.
Who did the luring?
Gabriel told him. The smile that appeared on Chamron's face made Gabriel wonder whether he was involved in the operation as well.
Is she coming here?
We spent a single day together, Gabriel said. We weren't able to make any plans.
I'm not sure I believe that, Chamron said warily. Surely you're not contemplating a return to Venice. Have you forgotten you've made the commitment to take over Special Ops?
No, I haven't forgotten.
By the way, your appointment will be made official when you return from Washington.
I'm counting the hours.
Chamron looked around the apartment.
Did you confess to Chiara that you gave away all her furniture?
She knows I had to make some changes to accommodate my studio.
She's not going to be happy, Chamron said. I'd give anything to see Chiara's face when she walks in here for the first time.
Chamron stayed for another hour, debriefing Gabriel about the attack on the Vatican. At 9:15, Gabriel walked him down to the car, then stood in the street for a moment and watched the taillights disappear around the corner. He went back upstairs and put the kitchen in order, then shut out the lights and went into his bedroom. Just then, the apartment block shook with the clap of a thunderous explosion. Like all Israelis, he had become adept at estimating the casualty toll of suicide bombs by counting the sirens. The more sirens, the more ambulances. The more ambulances, the more dead and wounded. He heard a single siren, then another, then a third. Not too large, he thought. He switched on the television and waited for the first bulletin. But 15 minutes after the explosion, there was still no word. In frustration, he picked up the phone and dialed Chamron's car. There was no answer. Part 2. Dr. Gachet's Daughter. Chapter 10. Ein Kerem, Jerusalem. Gila Chamron's life had been a succession of tense vigils. She had endured the secret missions to dangerous lands, the wars and the terror, the crises and the security cabinet meetings that never seemed to end before midnight. She had always feared an enemy from Chamron's past would one day rise and take his revenge. She had always known that one day Ari would force her to wait for word of whether he was going to live or die. Gabriel found her seated calmly in a private waiting room in the intensive care unit of the Hadassah Medical Center. Chamron's famous bomber jacket lay across her lap, and she was absently plucking at the tear in the right breast that Chamron had never seen fit to repair. Gabriel had always seen something of Golda Meir in Gila's sad gaze and wild gray hair. He could not look at Gila without thinking of the day Golda pinned a medal on his chest in secret, and with tears in her eyes thanked him for avenging the 11 Israelis murdered at Munich.
What happened, Gabriel? How did they get to Ari in the middle of Jerusalem?
He's probably been under surveillance for a very long time. When he left my apartment tonight, he told me he was going back to the Prime Minister's office to do a bit of work.
Gabriel sat down and took Gila's hand.
They hit him at the traffic signal on King George Street.
A suicide bomber?
We think there were two men. They were in a van and disguised as Haredi Jews. The bomb was abnormally large.
She looked up at the television mounted high on the wall.
I can see that from the pictures. It's remarkable anyone survived.
A witness saw Ari's car accelerate suddenly an instant before the bomb went off. Rami or the driver must have seen something that made them suspicious. The armor plating withstood the force of the blast, but the car was thrown into the air. Apparently, it rolled at least twice.
Who did this? Was it Hamas? Islamic Jihad? The Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades?
There's been a claim by the Brotherhood of Allah.
The same people who did the Vatican?
Yes, Gila.
Do you believe them?
It's early, Gabriel said. What have the doctors told you?
He's going to be in surgery for at least another 3 hours. They say we'll be able to see him when he comes out, but only for a minute or two. They've warned me he won't look good.
Gila studied him for a moment, then looked up at the television again.
You are worried he's not going to live, aren't you, Gabriel?
Of course I am.
Don't worry, said Gila. Shamron is indestructible. Shamron is eternal.
What did they tell you about his injuries?
She recited them calmly. The inventory of damaged organs, head trauma, and broken bones made clear to Gabriel that Shamron's survival was by no means assured.
Ari came through it the best of the three, Gila said. Apparently Rami and the driver were hurt much worse.
Poor Rami. He's been standing guard over Ari for years, and now this.
Where's Jonathan?
He was on duty in the north tonight. He's on his way.
Shamron's only son was a colonel in the Israel Defense Force. Ronit, his wayward daughter, had moved to New Zealand in order to get away from her domineering father. She was living there on a chicken farm with a Gentile. It had been years since she and Shamron had spoken.
Ronit's coming too, Gila said. Who knows? Maybe something good can come out of all this. Ronit's absence has been very hard on him. He blames himself, as well he should. Ari's very hard on his children. But then you know that, don't you, Gabriel?
Gila stared directly into Gabriel's eyes for a moment, then looked suddenly away. For years she had thought him a desk man of some sort, who knew much about art and spent a great deal of time in Europe. Like the rest of the country, she had learned the true nature of his work by reading the newspapers. Her demeanor toward him had changed since his unmasking. She was quiet around him, careful never to upset him, and incapable of looking him too long in the eye. Gabriel had seen behavior like Gila's before, as a child, whenever people had entered the Alon home. Death had left its mark on Gabriel's face, just as Birkenau had stained the face of his mother. Gila couldn't gaze long into his eyes because she feared what she might see there.
This is the end of disc number 2. Please insert disc number 3.